1979. When did you first go out, start working in the Arboretum?
Well, this was in 1943. When any graduate student left Professor Leopold's care, he always asked, what would you like to do? And if a student said, I'd like to teach, well, he tried to get the person into teaching. He said, I'd like to work with the conservation department. He tried to get the person in the conservation department, in federal service or whatever. So when my turn came, he said, what would you like to do? And I said to him, I'd like to be with you. I'd like to stay with you. And he didn't answer right away, and I thought, uh-oh, I said the wrong thing. And finally he looked at me and he said, okay, he said, oh, I don't have a place on you, place on my staff for an additional person, he said, but until I do, he said, you might want to try the Arboretum biologist, he said, we're in a close association there, until I can make necessary arrangements.
You mean take on that job?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So because Catton, who was then the Arboretum biologist, had just left for, I've forgotten where. And so I said, okay.
You were a graduate student.
I had gotten my master's degree. Mm-hmm. And so he arranged it. I didn't know the details. And so I got the job as the Arboretum biologist for $1,800 a year.
Is that a full-time job?
It was a full-time job. And began, I think, in April or May of 1943.
Mm-hmm.
I, of course, had been familiar with the Arboretum. I had done some work out there and seen the place, and so it was not unfamiliar to me.
Mm-hmm.
So it wasn't a difficult transition to make. Besides which, I was much interested in plant ecology. I had my minor professor was Dr. Fassett and Dr. Curtis.
Oh, yeah.
So, and I had taken the courses that they gave and was very much interested in experimental work in plant ecology, so this suited me fine.
Right. So you didn't live out there at the Arboretum?
No, I lived in town, and I commuted each day.
Yeah.
But I worked late, oftentimes nights during the summer. I worked evenings as well as during the day.
Were you doing research or maintenance kind of stuff?
No, I was entirely research. I had about six or seven projects going on plants and about the same number going on animals.
The Arboretum at that time, in other words, had a staff member who was devoting full time to research.
Yes. It was called the Arboretum biologist, and you had certain other things that they wanted you to do. For example, they expected you to exercise some judgment on planting, and but for the most part, this was very covetously done by Bill Longnecker, and he really.
And Curtis.
Well, no, more Longnecker than Curtis. Curtis would present the ideas, and then the degree to which they were followed through was a function of how Longnecker agreed with it. And because Longnecker controlled the work crew, that was his job. As it was called Arboretum Director, but actually the direction came from the Arboretum Committee, but that was his title, and he was in charge of the work crew. And in general, he did a pretty good job. Interesting aspect, he sometimes would do some very, very odd things, and I used to get to Tom Butson before they were done and explain to Tom why this was ecologically wrong, and Tom then just wouldn't do it, he'd overlook it.
Oh.
And he might get bawled out for it, but he'd hide like a rhinoceros anyway, it didn't bother him. And Tom and
Butson
I...
Butson was the crew foreman?
Yes.
Yeah.
He lived there, he lived on the Arboretum. He lived where... the Arboretum office now is. That was an old Army office building, and he lived there.
The administration office?
Yeah, where the administration office is, not the McKay Center.
Right.
Where the McKay Center was the old mess hall and cook shack.
Yeah.
But where Tom lived is the old officers' quarters, and it is now where the Army Administration Building is. But, well, let me give you an example of absolutely ludicrous maintenance. I was much interested in the Teal Pond as a bog area, and I became involved in tamarack research there. I wanted to see how tamaracks would reproduce and grow and so on. And one day I noticed that a road was cut, or a fire lane-like road was cut on the west side of the Teal Pond. And this was after I had become an instructor in wildlife management was some time later.
You mean after you were a biologist?
After I was a biologist. Because I it had to run over me, my dead body before they would be allowed to do this if I had been there. Or Tom would have stopped them, but Tom was then dead. What they did was smooth out a road and cover it with crushed limestone.
Where is this now?
On the west side of the Teal Pond. Mm-hmm. It's still there.
Mm-hmm.
Now here, and on the uphill side, I might add.
Well, there's a fire lane.
That's a fire lane. That was crushed gravel, all calcareous, on the uphill side of a bog that was supposed to be acid.
Oh.
What the hell kind of ecological thinking is this? So I went to the Arboretum Committee and I said, you got to stop this. This is ludicrous. They said, well, we've got to maintain. I said, what are you maintaining? He said, we've got to maintain the projects. I said, what do you think this tamarack research is? Isn't that our project? I said, you've disrupted this bog that we were trying to simulate to being an acid bog. You put limestone on the uphill side of it. I could have been talking to 10 sticks for as much response as I got. Long Neck had made a decision. It was a fait accompli. And nobody, and I mean nobody, would say, look, that move was wrong. Take out that thing. Reroute your road wherever you want it to be, but don't destroy the Teal Pond habitat. No way. To this day, that road is on the north side of the Teal Pond.
Sure.
But it were these kinds of decisions that were... I worked like a dog on the Grady Tract, building an experiment to see which of the oaks would best grow on the Grady, because we wanted to do something with oaks on the Grady. So I had extreme difficulty during the later stages of World War II. I bribed somebody from the College of Agriculture, one of the people who had worked on the farm, with two boxes of shotgun shells, which I had access to and he didn't. If he'd come out and plow a strip about two harrows wide that I could use to plant white oak, black oak, and bur oak, which he did.
Plant acorns,
you mean? Plant acorns. And I hired a man with funds from the Bun Fund.
Nice.
We went out and gathered acorns.
You were involved in administering that fund then?
Yes. We gathered the acorns, black, white, and burr, and planted them in plots.
Yeah.
And every tenth one, after it came up, I screened to be sure that nothing, no mouse or whatever, got at it. And then we were measuring the growth rates of these each year. After 2 years, I came out to do my measuring, and it was all plowed up. I couldn't believe my eyes. So I immediately went to Long Neck and I said, you ran a plow right through the middle of my oak experiment. He said, yes, I know. I said, but why? He said, well, we've got to protect it. I said, what are you protecting? He was protecting the arboretum by destroying my experiment. I said, why couldn't you put it on the east side of my experiment? Then if I got fire and lost, it would be my own fault, rather than to deliberately destroy it under the name of protection. All right? That one was down the drain. Then I had an experience.
Now, this is after you're a member of the staff, but up here in wildlife ecology?
Yes.
And you're just using the arboretum as a research area?
But the planting was done while I was a biologist there.
I see.
But the measuring was done afterward.
Yeah. When did you leave as biologist?
I think I was there 2 years.
43 and 4.
Yeah. 43, 44, and part of 45.
Yeah.
And then I became an instructor in wildlife ecology.
Which was Leopold's department?
Yeah, yeah. There were just two of us. He was a professor, and I was an instructor. There was quite a gap between us. As a matter of fact, there always was in terms of responsibility. He always had the major responsibility, and I was really his assistant, which I was quite happy to be.
Yeah.
And if you were alive today, I would still be quite happy to be his assistant, but that's the way it was.
Yeah.
At any rate...
Well, tell me about him.
About Leopold? There's so much, it's difficult to know where to begin or end, but as far as the arboretum was concerned...
Tell me about his connection with the arboretum.
Well, he was involved very early in almost all of the arboretum's activities. And he was very active. So was John Curtis. So those two were really the spearheads. But the fellow who isn't given enough credit, really, for his activities on the arboretum is Norman Fassett.
Hmm.
Normally because he was not a gung-ho type. He was not... If you wanted to do something stupid, he wasn't going to arm wrestle you to the ground and try to convince you. You just had to stew in your own juice. But he had a lot of good ideas for the arboretum. I used to pay particular attention to Dr. Fassett because he was very, very sharp. People think he's mostly think of him as a taxonomist,
mm-hmm.
but he was a first-rate ecologist as well. At least in my book, he was. And I think you'll find that his students would subscribe to that as well.
What did he contribute to the growing arboretum idea?
Well, one of the things that he was opposed to, as was Curtis, was the continued expansion of the areas that were mowed by lawnmowers.
Oh, yeah.
And he thought, as I thought, as John Curtis thought, that the lilac plantation, in its infancy, should have been shifted to Picnic Point. And there expand, and the other area could have been used for other things. We had a very fine habitat for short-billed marsh wrens in that area.
Uh-huh.
We had lots of short-billed marsh wrens.
Was that an old field?
Yeah, it was an old field. And they just mowed grass, mowed more grass, and increased the grass mowing, increased the need for more people.
Yeah.
But there was no way that the instructor...
For that, why did it not develop that way?
Because nobody was willing to argue with Longnecker.
Oh, Longnecker wanted, of course, the
Oh,
gardens,
sure, absolutely.
Which are now named after him.
That's right.
Yeah.
You see, he sabotaged, but he didn't do anything in this regard. And nobody came to grips with him, because if you did, and he quit as arboretum director, no one on the committee that I'm aware of was willing to accept that responsibility, because it was a substantial one. You had to be responsible for the work crew, for the salaries, for all kinds of other things as well.
Did Longenecker run the arboretum from down here on campus?
Yes.
In the horticulture?
Yes. That's where he ran it from his office. And while he had many, many admirable characters, he had a lot of peculiar ones as well. And while I liked him personally, his ecological judgment was sometimes... pretty far
now
off the
I
mark.
I understood that Longenecker played an important role in laying out the arboretum.
That could have been. That would be before my time.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I'm not surprised about that at all.
Well, is it fair then to ascribe the so-called arboretum idea to Leopold, Fassett, and Curtis, pretty much?
That is the natural aspects to them, yes.
Yeah.
I don't believe they had anything to do with the horticultural or design of the arboretum. I don't believe they had anything to do with that at all. I'm pretty sure that fell somewhere in Longnecker's bailiwick.
Yeah.
And that was his entree into the committee and as director.
Yeah.
well.
How much time did Leopold spend out there?
Well, no, he didn't. He spent as much time when I knew him as he did with me. When I was there, he spent lots of time, and even after I became an instructor, we would do things together at the Arboretum. For example, the woodcock census that I've carried out every year.
Yeah.
he was carrying out one at the same time on his place in Sauk County. So we would compare notes, and he was interested in my plant experiments, which I had a number of plant experiments out there, some of which have been published, some of which have not been. The one on prolepsis, for example, double tipping in pines, has already been published, and the tamarack has not. And I had 1, 2, 3, 4 prairie studies that have never been published.
Mostly they haven't been?
No.
Will be?
Doubtful. First of all, I was not a fast writer, and I wasn't trying to make a mark anywhere. I was, when Leopold was alive, I was where I wanted to be. I wasn't going to go anywhere. I didn't want to go anywhere else.
You wanted to work with Leopold?
Yes. I wasn't in a great rush to go anywhere, so I did all kinds of research. If the research interested him, that was about as much satisfaction as I needed to get out of it.
Why were you so willing to place yourself under Leopold for an indefinite period like that?
No. I just liked him. I liked the way he thought. I liked the way he wrote. I liked the way he treated me. I liked his enthusiasm for the things that I was doing and that we were doing together. Mm-hmm. No, we just had good rapport. We had good chemistry between us. And so I had no desire to go anywhere else. The stuff he was doing was so far out in front of most anyway, which I learned later, didn't know at the time, that we were running in front of a lot of research organizations. Mm-hmm. It was a rather substantial blow when he died.
I'm sure.
So, but then I had a great backlog of things, and I got involved in the department. And then before I could get myself organized, I became chairman of the department, was responsible for the administration and the maintenance of a department that was his, and we couldn't let it slide into oblivion. And so it was, I had abandoned a lot of these things. But I kept up a great many. For example, I used to keep records on the prairie research, I kept records on the tamarack research, I kept records on the woodcock research.
The trillium.
And the trillium research. All those things. I kept records on all that to keep things going.
Right
up to this day.
When did you join the Arboretum Committee?
Well, I was on the Arboretum Committee, I can't give you the exact years, but I was on the Arboretum Committee as a biologist. And then after I became an assistant professor here, I was appointed on the Arboretum Committee. I must have been on the committee for 10 or 15 years or more. And when I went to Ireland as a Fulbright professor for a year, the administration asked who I would like to have in my place, and I suggested Bob Ellerson. And when I came back a year later, Bob enjoyed the chairmanship so much, and he was a good chairman, not even chairman of the Arboretum Committee, he enjoyed the position on the Arboretum Committee so much that I didn't have the heart to ask to go back on. As a matter of fact, it was one job less for me, and I was quite happy to have Bob do it. And he was a very good man, and he ultimately became, as I mentioned earlier, chairman of the Arboretum Committee, and did a good job of that as well. So the trade was a good one for the Arboretum, I'm sure. But that's my tenure ended at in 1969-70, when I spent a year in Ireland. And I always kept very close tabs on it through Bob. Bob always reported to me and any changes that were made.
Well, tell me about the activities of the Arboretum Committee during the 50s and 60s. What kind of a body was that? How did they operate?
Well, it was a very interesting group. And oftentimes, strong disagreement between Longnecker and Curtis, sometimes Longnecker and me, sometimes between Curtis and myself on certain things. But in the end, Curtis and I almost stood alone in many things.
Curtis had been your minor professor.
Yes.
Yeah.
And eventually we were on the same side almost constantly.
What were the issues?
And the issues were such things, again, as the amount of time and effort to given to horticulture activities versus the same kind of investment in time and money given to research efforts.
Yeah.
And we were strong to move the horticultural aspects to Picnic Point, where they would not only be easier handled logistically by departments of the university, but would be easy to handle in terms of public. We wanted to keep the public away from the research area, which the Arboretum was essentially supposed to be at that time. Now it, of course, is developed more into an educational group rather than a research group. But at that time, it was supposed to be a research area. And with people tromping around and running off the roads with cars and bicycles and motorcycles, I held a police badge, still do as a matter of fact, for the Arboretum.
Oh, really?
Sure. My badge is, I still have it at home. It's number 13.
Town of Madison?
No, University Police.
Oh, University.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When I retire, I'll give it back to them just for the hell of it. But those are some of the things. But we had good men on the Arboretum Committee. Jim Jackson was a very good man. John Curtis, Facet when he was on. These were Art Hassler.
Oh, yes.
These were really good people. They, I never had any difficulties with the ecology group. The most peculiar aspect is that if you now today mention the errors or the alleged errors that members of the Arboretum Committee made, of course, you're looked upon as a crank and an oddball. But if you were to examine in detail the opportunities lost through mismanagement, this would be a fantastic array of mistakes. The one I mentioned to you, where they sold the area east of Fish Hatchery Road.
Yes.
And destroyed a beautiful woods full of native wildflowers.
When was that?
Oh, I would say that was destroyed about 1948 or 49, somewhere in there. I can't remember exactly when.
Did the Arboretum Committee
they
sell
sold
that
it.
Did they have any choice in the matter?
Oh, sure. They just summarily sold it. The buyers were never consulted on this. This was done by Galistel and McCaffrey and Peterson, that group. And if the biologists were consulted, I was never aware of it. Certainly I was not consulted. Certainly Leopold was not consulted. They cut down the trees, dragged the timber down into the marsh, took bulldozers and removed this was a hill on which there was a deciduous woods.
Yeah.
And with bulldozers, they moved that land into the marsh, covered it all up, made it into what looked like first a ragweed patch and ultimately as some sort of a grass sward, and then they sold it to Madison newspapers. Now this, in my opinion, was an error of great magnitude as far as the Arboretum was concerned, and certainly lacked foresight by people who were paid to have foresight. But that's the way it goes.
You participated in the early burning experiments.
All of them. All of them except the first year at Kattenhusen. I've forgotten Kattenhusen's first name. But anyway, Kattenhusen did the first one, burns, and then I did the next 5 or 6 years. I was in charge of those burns.
Well, whose idea were they?
Apparently Curtis's. It was not my idea. I was merely following a plan that either Kattenhusen or Kattenhusen and Curtis or Facet devised.
Yeah,
they were. The idea was not mine.
Well, how did you work that in the earliest experiments?
Well, first of all, we burned several different times. I'd have to go to my notes to look, but we burned twice in spring. I think we had a May burn, April burn, and a May burn, and we burned again in August or September. We had a fall burn, and I looked. I don't know if anybody else ever looked at it. If John Curtis ever looked at it, he never looked at it to my knowledge. And this is not to say he didn't observe it. But I looked at these all summer long, all the time, because I was working on the prairie a good deal. And I never saw anyone except myself examining these plots. And it appeared that the Mayburn was the best one. And this is the recommendation that I had made. So eventually the August and the very early and the very late burn, the August fall burn, was abandoned.
Yeah.
And just the spring burn was used, and that's the one that's used today.
Well, what was the prairie like at that stage?
Well, it was very little actual prairie plants. And the chances of the prairie coming in was very poor because the soil was very, very, first of all, the amount of vegetation was very light. And we had difficulty getting enough fuel to burn.
Yeah.
So when it burned, it exposed the ground. And the sun baked it almost as hard as this table. And there was no way that any prairie could get started. And that's why the other experiment, where we desodded, raked the prairie, and put the seeds in, that it actually began to work.
So you're saying it wasn't the fire that tipped the balance?
Heck no, I don't think the fire maintained. But the best seeding did not come from the burns at all. The best seeding came in naturally from the distribution from the areas that were disrupted and plants either put in as plants or seeded.
I see.
But then it gradually seeded. But some of the most striking prairie natural revegetation occurred adjacent to a plot that I was working on that had nothing to do with burning. And I think that once the prairie is established, then I think your burns are great. But to establish prairie with burns where you take off what little vegetation you have and expose the soil to the hot rays of the sun is not conducive to prairie propagation.
In those early burns, though, you were burning small areas?
We were burning long strips. They were about, I think they were about 10 to 15 feet wide, and they must have run 40, 50 yards long. I have the notes in my file still on these burns.
Oh, yes.
And
did this strike you as an odd idea at the time?
No, I thought it was a good idea, except that I didn't agree with the conclusions that were drawn from it. I thought some of the conclusions were okay, and I thought others were a little bit stronger.
In the early paper, you mean?
Yes.
What were the problems
there? I've forgotten what the details of what it was. If I look it up, I can remember again. It's a long time ago.
Who was Parch?
Max Parch was a student of Curtis's who also had a great interest in wildlife. He's a very good man, very good. Max has a genuine gut interest in prairies. And of all Curtis's student on prairies, I think Max was the top student. He was a very easygoing fellow, never hard-nosed or hard-headed about anything, always willing to listen to other options on ideas that he had. He worked on the Fable Grove prairie mostly. So Max Parch is still around working on prairies. He's at St. Cloud State University or whatever in Minnesota, but. Max is a good man.
Did he work with you on the burn?
No, he did not.
Well, the paper finally came out, Curtis and Parch.
I know.
Yeah.
They never asked me.
You were just acting as essentially a
technician. Well, they treated me as I read a biologist, they treated me as a laborer.
Yeah.
Not Max. But John regarded me as sort of a peon, so, and I didn't mind. Regardless of what the brash things John Curtis may have done, I think he was one of the really outstanding plant ecologists in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the regard in which I held him.
Really?
I had a great deal of respect for John Curtis. He didn't allow much running room for other people's ideas. But fortunately, he had a lot of good ones of his own that he didn't have to worry too much. But John was a very, very astute botanist. And we didn't always see eye to eye early on, but in the latter years of his life, we got on really well, and I enjoyed John Curtis.
Let me stop this attic.
said that to whom?
Faldo, to the first Leopold. Yeah. He said, fine, go ahead. And we passed him out to the committee, and I never in my life saw such a cool reception. They didn't, simply because the arboretum was run out of Albert Galestel's vest pocket.
Why would he object to this?
I don't know. But there might have been some things that I would say that I had privy to, that I might say in a newsletter, that might be awkward for him. That's the only reason I can guess. And I don't know what I would have said that would have been awkward, but I think that thought occurred to me by hindsight. Because after I mentioned Prof. Leopold, I said, you know, not only did this get no enthusiasm, I said, I felt that they were sometimes downright hostile to some of this. I said, to hell with them. I said, I'm not going to do it anymore. I said, I was doing this over and above what I was expected to do. And so he said, okay, because I suspected that he thought something was awry too, but I never found out what it was.
Well, how were you circulating it? What was the audience? Around campus here? Or?
Yeah, it was around campus, students, university staff, and a few lay people, like Colonel Jackson and some of his cohorts. There was at one time an organization, I've forgotten what it was called, Friends of the Landscape? Or something like that. It was a Longneckers group. They got this. But I stopped after the second one. There was, you know, I was just getting no enthusiasm, no encouragement, and some hostility. Well, not hostility in terms of being reprimanded or bullied, but just sort of a negative attitude toward it, and I thought, to hell with that. Anyways, I wouldn't do it anymore. And I didn't. So, I don't know how to account for these things. Of course, I was low on the totem pole. They always regarded me as Leopold's flunky. And Hassler once said to me, he said, you're a fool to stay in that job. He said, you'll never be regarded as anything but Leopold's assistant. And I said to him, well, if that holds, I'm quite happy with that arrangement. He said, well, that's up to you. But he said, if you want to make a name for yourself, you better get out of that position you're in to follow a man as great as Leopold. And I knew this would be the case, but I didn't care. And that I was never going to cut as wide a swath, and there was no need in my thinking that that would be the case if I had moved elsewhere. So I just stayed put.
Yeah.
But that I resented. I really resented the fact that they gave me the tough treatment. The only fellow who would know about that currently would be Art Hassler, because he's the only person still alive that's on that committee. That was on that committee.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
At that time.
When
this came out.
Yeah. And whether he was party to it. You see, there were two groups on the Arboretum Committee. The administrative groups, and they were high up, like Peterson, McCaffrey, Galestel. They were high up in administration. Yeah. Then there were the biologist types, like Hassler and Leopold, myself and others. And while we always met together, some of the basic decisions were not made, nor were they ever cleared by the biologists. And I don't know why, but salaries were always kept extremely low, budgets were very tight, simply because there never was an Arboretum budget. The Arboretum budget was discussed verbally as part of the budget for buildings and grounds. And Galestel ran it like he ran the buildings and grounds department. And I said, now what rank do I have if I come in here as biologist? Oh, he said, you have the rank of an instructor. But I don't, so far I haven't gotten credit for those couple of years.
No.
As an instructor. And the simple reason was that I was being paid as a laborer by Galestel, although they gave me a fancy title. And I didn't care at the time because I knew I wasn't going to be there forever, because I'd worked out this arrangement with Professor Leopold. And land that could have been bought, for example, the houses adjacent to the Olbrich entrance, between the Olbrich entrance and the highway, that group of houses, a little street in there, it dead ends. That piece of land could have been purchased for peanuts in the early days, but nobody had the guts, or the inclination, rather, to fight for this.
I should think that someone like Jackson would have been...
Jackson was in with the administrative groups.
Yeah.
Jackson, Galistel, McCaffrey, they operated within the Arboretum Committee as an almost autocratic unit.
Now, which Jackson are you talking about?
Colonel Jackson.
Colonel Jackson.
Yeah.
But he wasn't interested in that property?
No, he was more interested in other types of property. And the details, I don't know. This is still very vague because it's 30 years ago or more. But I remember, because what would happen in many cases was that Tom Butson had access to almost all the first-rate scuttlebutt because he was a member of Buildings and Grounds. He also had access to Longnecker, and I had access to Tom, so I didn't have any direct pipeline to any of these people. But Tom and I worked day in, day out, side by side, so I got all of this. And later on, when I became an instructor in the department, Tom and I were still very close, and he and I would talk about Arboretum business that wasn't generally known. Anytime you write about any of this thing, it's always sweetness and light. There were never any problems, everything worked smoothly. You know, this is rubbish. It wasn't the case that way at all. There was constant bickering. Actually, some downright knockdown, drag-out fights on in the Arboretum Committee. All in all, I think it was healthy. But you never get that picture from anyone. No one ever said anything. And nobody ever really took a really tough stand. Perhaps being run out of Galistel's pocket with an inner core of administrators may have been the salvation of the Arboretum. Who knows?
Mm-hmm.
Without that, we may have lost the whole business. Mm-hmm. One never knows. But there were some things that sure were peculiar from an administrative and ecological point of view that I see now by hindsight.
Yeah.
And,
what was Curtis' mode of operating out there? Did he have an office out there?
No, he never had an office out there. He was research director, and we had a research meeting periodically, and I attended all of these. And he did very well. Curtis did very well. You know, he was not a fellow that did a lot of belly laughing, mind you. He was a very solemn individual, very
solemn.
Very stoic, very sharp, and very unyielding on almost any of his activities. Unfortunately, he was right a good deal of the time, so that, he didn't get himself into any real jams.
Mm-hmm.
But he did a good job, and he handled the research director's obligations from his office in Botany in the basement.
Oh.
He had an office in the basement of the Birch Hall.
He did quite a bit of research out there.
Oh, he? Yes. Yes. And he directed a lot of students. Well, there are a lot of peculiarities and little aspects of Arboretum activities that it's a long time for me to recall.
Oh, sure.
See, I haven't been on the Arboretum Committee in 10 years, and things get pretty vague. The only time that I was really sensitized is when a lot of my research was undermined or lost because of either carelessness or whatever. I had a project in which I was attempting to determine the growth and spread of Laryngium Iacopholium, rattlesnake master. And I had a series of plots set up. And one day I came and it was all mowed down. Mowed, mind you. I didn't even think you could get a mower in the area then. So I called John Curtis. I said, look, all these projects were supposed to be registered, that no one else could go in there. Well, he said, yes, that's true. Well, I said, they're all mowed down. He said, I don't always, that can't be. I said, come on out and look. Well, he didn't come out, but I did. And I went up to the caretaker. I said, you mowed over my plots. I said, I want this to be as natural as possible. Oh, I'm awfully sorry, he said. I said, yeah, but it's too late to be sorry. You've got to be cognizant of what you're doing before you do it, not apologize afterward. So what did he do? He got a whole bunch of these things that weren't on the plots at all and carried them by arms full and dumped them onto the plots.
Like mulch.
Exactly. And if they shed seeds, fine, but that it wasn't a natural shedding of seeds. So that went down the drain. I couldn't use that anymore. So, and, you know, well, these accidents continually occurred to my plant research. But fortunately, the wildflowers and the tamarack survived in spite of it.
Just tell me one more thing. I'm always interested in Leopold's participation in the development of the arboretum. For example, in the East Marsh, was he involved in the dredging that was done down there? Do you know? That might have been before you.
Well, that was well before. For the Gardner Ponds, you mean?
Yeah.
No, that.
The ponds and those channels.
That yeah, that those are the Gardner Ponds and channels.
Yeah.
I can't tell you that because I don't know. If he were involved. He didn't never let me know, but I suspected, looking at the old plans and Bill Longnecker had just drawer on drawer of these plans for the arboretum. I think they were largely Bill Longnecker's doing. Leopold had this involvement. I now recollect, he did have an involvement in these ponds, not in the channels and ditches, but in the ponds, the Gardner Ponds themselves, because he wanted to develop these as shorebird ponds where they could control the water levels, largely through the outlet into Murphy's Creek. And you remember, if you do remember, or I can tell you, that these had underwater gates that you put down a long hook and could lift up a gate and draw the water down. And then when you went down, you pushed down, they were like submarine caps.
Hatches
would go raise and lower them underwater. The water in the ponds, unfortunately, got so high that it went right over the top of the containing structure. And now, of course, you have the same thing, except that you have culverts instead of an overflow. But there used to be underwater release mechanism, largely for control of water in those ponds, but also, incidentally, to control the water levels for Lost City. Because in high water years, basements would flood because the water became saturated and the water table was very high.
Yeah.
Now, there's a drain field in the East Marsh, a tile drain field. There was years ago. One spring I was out trapping mink, and I heard the roar of water. And I couldn't imagine where it was going. And I finally found a place right in the middle of the marsh where there was a drain, and water was going in there at an incredible clip. And so I checked around, and sure enough, I found that it was a drain field. How did I know this? Because Galestel knew. Did he tell anybody? Was it ever put on paper? Heck no.
When was that installed?
Who knows? But Galestel knew it was there. Galestel's stock in trade was that he knew where every sewer pipe, every underground wire, everything, where it went, where it came from, where it was going, how much it cost, and how it could be changed. But I don't know this as a fact, but I'd wager my arm to the elbow, most of that has never been recorded. He knew it in his head, and you had to go and ask him if you wanted it, and he never volunteered. I never knew in Galestel to volunteer any kind of information.
You worked with him?
Oh, yeah, constantly. And as a matter of fact, during the war, we had a victory garden in the camp nursery together, side by side. So I knew Albert very well and liked him very well.
You had gardens now?
Yeah, victory gardens. Right in the field nursery, in the camp nursery.
Which is where?
Right where your nursery is, behind the buildings.
Yeah.
Yeah, we had victory gardens in that. Well, I liked Albert Gallistel, but he ran the Arboretum to suit Albert Gallistel. And he had, and who knows, as I said before, but what this may have been the only way that he could survive during those times, that I don't know. Albert, I may be indirectly maligning him, when actually, if it hadn't been done Albert's way, it may not have been done at all. But as I say, some things were very peculiar to my eye, and there's no way that I have any proof of anything other than to guess by hindsight. So that's the story, is, you know, bits and pieces of information. The one you want to ask about these, and to verify my assessments, is to talk with Art Hassler. See, he has a slightly different perspective than I, because he was senior to me by a good deal, but he would know something about the very things that I'm talking about.
End of tape, June 27th, 1979. You were telling me that Curtis wrote the burning paper without talking to you very much.
Well, there was no need for him to, yes, that's true. There was really no need, because if he regarded my role in this effort as simply a laborer burning the prairie, there was no need for him to talk to me. I think I could have straightened him out on a couple of points in the paper that I thought he was stretching.
He didn't have close experience with the burning himself.
In all the years that I was there, Curtis, I never saw Curtis on the prairie at the burns or at any time during the time I worked there.
That's funny, because he was quite a field biologist, I understand.
Oh yeah, he was a super biologist.
Yeah,
and he wasn't afraid of the field at all. No, he was not an armchair biologist by a long shot.
But even to miss out on the fun of the burning, it strikes me as kind of strange.
No, John was not for mundane labor.
No?
No, I don't think John got any kind of kick out of that. I don't think he had great rapport with people. He was not a fellow that could joke and get people to work for nothing and enjoy it. So he was quite happy to have somebody else do it, and he looked at the finished product.
Yeah.
And I don't say that in any derogatory way at all. But John was a good field biologist. I've just finished reviewing these tapes, and I noted that there were several errors, largely from trying to speak too rapidly. Several points need to be clarified. One, when I was talking about an oak experiment, I used in the tapes white, black, and burr. What I should have said was white, red, and burr. Also, I mentioned Colonel Jackson's name is Jim. I don't recall now what Colonel Jackson's first name was, because we referred to him as either Colonel or Bud.